Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you have a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a future segment on Crime Wire, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And before we begin, you know, we have a pretty wide audience across the country. If you are in Virginia, North Carolina, Maryland, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, there is an Amber Alert for a 12-year-old girl by the name of Brittany Mae Smith. The child is believed to be in extreme danger and was last seen around or about December 1st at 3341 Fort Lewis Crest, Salem, Virginia. She is in danger, and chances are she might still be alive. Her mother was found murdered by the person who is with her now, according to police. This is, again, very important because, you know, in a lot of these cases, we don't see, you know, victims who could survive. And there is a question whether she was, you know, the person that was with the mother was hurting her in some way, either sexually, but he did abduct her. That's what police think. And there is a chance. So this might sound kind of crazy, but for those listening, and this does work, and I know Vito, you would agree, is that when, you know, motels, very small motels off the back roads of Virginia, off the back roads of Maryland, if you know somebody that's working there, maybe get your churches to put out some posters, because this child could still be alive. And on the Crime Wire site, we put up information on her case, the car that they could possibly be driving. She's going to be looking for about a 32-year-old man and a young 12-year-old girl whose mother was just murdered. And maybe she knows about it, and maybe she doesn't. Vito, any other suggestions?
The whole thing is to get that picture of that guy and that car up every place. Every place, not only limited to those states, which are important, but, you know, all the places. Because the guy's going to, you know, the guy has to sleep, the guy has to eat, he has to do all of those things. He's going to need some money eventually. He's going to need an ATM. Got to have all the people see this, because this is dangerous. If he did kill this woman, he has nothing to lose by killing this girl or armed robberies or do whatever he has to do, you know?
That's right. And in some cases, in these cases, because if the child was somebody that he is very fond of, you know, he may preserve her for a little bit longer, if hopefully that's the case. So people really need to be lookout. I mean, Denny, you see him in New York when you were there, in these very small towns and these places. People don't pay attention, do they?
Not usually, not as much as they should, and you and Vito are both right. Need to get the pictures up there and concentrate on the places where if somebody was on the lam or trying to hide or keep out of the public eye, where they would be likely to go, which would be your out-of-the-way places, your out-of-the-way motels and restaurants and so forth.
Well, thank you, everybody. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, yes, tonight we're going to update the case of Daniel Underwood. On September 4th, 2008, 33-year-old Daniel Ray Underwood, his girlfriend Rebecca Nelson, and a friend, Maria Harvick, were at a bar in East Fork, Texas. The three then went back to the home Daniel and Rebecca shared in Sulphur Springs, Texas. According to Maria, once there, Daniel and Rebecca got into an argument, and Maria left the room. A short time later, She went back into the room and saw Daniel holding a shotgun in his right hand and accusing Rebecca of taking all his money and burying him in debt. Rebecca grabbed the gun and a struggle ensued. Maria again left the room, and seconds later she heard the gun go off. When she stepped back into the hallway, she saw Daniel fall to the floor, mortally wounded. His death was ruled a suicide. However, Donna Underwood, Daniel's mother, doesn't believe her son took his own life. She'll join us tonight to discuss the latest developments along with crime lawyer, consultant, and statement analyst Peter Hyatt. Peter recently analyzed transcripts of statements made to police by Rebecca Nelson, Daniel's live-in girlfriend, after the shooting. Welcome to both of you, Donna and Peter.
Thank you, Danny. Glad to be here.
And it's
Peter. Thank you for having me.
Peter, greetings. Listen, Donna, the case now, is it accurate as far as I described it to so far?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And you didn't believe that this was a case of suicide almost from the get-go. And you've obtained the tapes of the statements that Rebecca Nelson gave to police over several interviews within a few days of the shooting. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And Peter, you got involved here and actually analyzed, as you do as a statement analyst, the transcripts of those interviews with Rebecca. Is that correct?
Yes. And Denny, I'd like to say that it is an honor to be on the program with someone of Donna's courage. I think that her loss is just an unbearable difficulty to bear, and for her to have gone and taken the steps that we needed to take to get the interviews and then to get them transcribed, it's a lot of work to be done, and I can only imagine what it must have been like to go through those and listen to them and to hear those things and know that a mother's instinct is saying one thing and a police conclusion is saying another. And then when I was asked to analyze the interviews, I knew the allegation was that he had shot himself, and that's basically all I knew about the case. And for statement analysis, we don't want to know anything more than just the allegation so that the language can speak for itself. And what I did was I began to slowly, so it's a lot of work, but slowly to analyze the interviews that were conducted, and a picture began to emerge for me, and I made some suggestions regarding what I believe that the interviews were showing, and it was difficult. I found that he was with me when I went to sleep at night. I thought about it when I took the interviews to my son's hockey games, and in between periods I would work on them, and I began to enter into emotionally what I think that his mother went through, and reliving all these things over and over. And so I offer to CrimeWire and to Don and the family, not simply my condolences, but perhaps some indicators of where this could go and maybe what really did happen that day.
Okay, Peter, before we get into your actual analysis, let me bring Donna back in for a minute. Donna, since we've talked the last time we were on the air profiling the case, in addition to the transcripts and Peter's analysis, has there been any other movement on the case? Has anything else happened of interest?
Well, right now, I want to say that I really appreciate Amanda St. Clair. She transcribed the police interviews so that Peter would have them in writing. And he has done, they have both put in so many hours. I want to thank both of them. And Gene with Citizens Against Homicide, I want to thank him too for agreeing to come in and help me, lead me through a lot of the criminal justice system that, you know, I need help with. They'll be profiling Daniel in the coming months on their monthly newsletter. And we hope we can, you know, see something come about by that. But I haven't done a whole lot. My husband has passed away after an auto accident. So really the transcripts of the police interviews that Peter has done has been the biggest thing right now.
Okay. Peter, I think without further ado, could you take us through what you found when you analyzed these transcripts, when you did your analysis?
So I found an interviewer that seemed to scratch the surface in the interview at times. He did pick up on one deceptive area in her answers. But there came a period of time where he seemed to gloss over so many things, and at least in the beginning, there were some indicators that were ignored. But towards the end, it became to the point where I was able to conclude, Denny, that had Rebecca been given a polygraph, she wouldn't have passed. With statement analysis, we can tell if someone is being deceptive. If there's enough indicators of high sensitivity, we can conclude that they're being deceptive. We can't always say why they're being deceptive, what their motive is. Sometimes it's clear, but most times we can just say this person is being deceptive. For instance, if I talked about with you about drug abuse, your answers would not show much sensitivity. If I talked to you about your involvement, commitment to families that have lost loved ones, we would see an increase in sensitivity, but not to the point where it would then suggest deception. She reached the point, Rebecca did, that she literally almost says to him, I'm withholding information from you and you're not going to get it from me, and he let it go, and it was very surprising. So I think the first thing that comes off is that Rebecca is a violent person. And
can you just talk to, because I don't know the answer to this, is this different in doing these intimate partners cases? Is it different than, say, a stranger or a father in the cases that you analyze? Is this any different? Is there a certain pattern that someone who's in a relationship with someone that possibly had something to do with the crime is different in their wording, or is different in their association of how they tell the facts or don't tell them?
It really is. There's a certain element of shame that goes on that we sometimes expect to see, and you know, in domestic violence cases. But here, she herself was a violent person. She talked about getting into a bar fight as if it was nothing. And again, for a woman, this is quite unusual. But in the beginning, it starts off with she describes him and her as being this wonderful relationship, that they never argue, they never have any trouble. And that simply doesn't exist on the earth. That's just impossible to grasp. So the first thing he should say to himself as he's interviewing her is, why does she need to present herself as someone of perfection, of a relationship that's perfect? Now, he did, and it's difficult to criticize other people's analysis and other people's interviewing skills, but there were some 101 things, we call them, in interviewing that he violated. Compound questions, introducing language, in an attempt to be sympathetic and gain a bond. He was really giving away different ideas for himself. But there were some major blunders there. But let's start with the first thing, is that she describes their relationship as being basically perfect. And then she goes into money, and she's very repetitive about money. And she wants to portray that there is no money issues. Now, if you know a couple that never argues, that's a wonderful couple, but if you know a couple that never argues and has no money problems, I'd like to meet them. It's just too extreme.
So she's trying to tell you that her world, just in her words, is hunky-dory.
Right, and she had a need to present her world as hunky-dory, and that is what is concerning. Why does she have a need to present this so well? If this is a suicide, there's no reason for deception. And she has the... for instance, the conversation goes back to money repeatedly, and he questioned her. He said, you know, come on, everyone has problems like that. Everyone has trouble getting along. Everyone has trouble paying the bills. No, not her, not her. Another thing is we look at the pronoun usage. Whose money? It's estimated that probably 90% of all murders take place under the word my or mine. And there were some indicators that this relationship was extremely tense, that there was some depressive issues that were going on. Then, as we progressed along, I felt in her language, and Donna, I'm so sorry to repeat some of these sensitive things that have to do with your son.
Okay,
I think that she was unfaithful to him. I'm sorry?
I said, that's fine. You couldn't tell You couldn't say anything that would surprise me or hurt me or anything.
It's hurtful to know, but I think that she was cheating on him.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was another love interest there. And we have a deceased human being, we have a weapon that's been fired, and we have a male and female in a relationship, and the interviewer is not following up about money and about their relationship. We don't see that very often, that type of ignoring of these blaring symbols here.
Peter, can I ask you, you mentioned that the interviewers didn't conduct the best interview in the world. I don't imagine there's any way to tell without seeing other examples of his interviewing skills, whether this was just a sloppy job or whether maybe he requires more training. Or I'm just trying to think. You said there were some glaring things, 101 type things, and I'm just trying to get my head around that and wondering, you know, what would cause that? If there's, and again, there's probably no way to tell without comparing these interviews with others he's done to see if it's the same.
Well, in general, in training, oftentimes in law enforcement, there'll be, you know, 200 hours training on firearms, 200 hours of training on how to operate a motor vehicle in every condition under every possible trying circumstance. But very little training on interviewing. And interviewing basically is this, is that if I am interviewing Donna, Donna has the information, I don't. And so there are certain rules that I follow. I ask Donna what happened and what happened next. So those are magical questions. But then I won't ask her, for instance, compound questions. I won't ask her questions that contain the answer. And this is another thing that he did, was a 101 violation, is he sometimes worded questions in such a way as, like, well, this is what you were thinking.
Well, it's because he was a woman, I think. I mean, it goes to what we have been seeing is that women who are before an investigator or before a circumstance where they might be involved are immediately, I think, dismissed by what they do and don't ask. Could that have been the case in this one?
Oh, I could not agree more. As a matter of fact, if you look deeply into his words, the interviewer's words, he probably is a gentleman and probably a decent guy. He was so concerned about not offending her and being apologetic. And this was not someone, and this is on the video, and I don't go into this too much in terms of body language, but it's there. This is not someone that was grieving. This is someone that in my estimation, had well moved on. And I think, frankly, that she seized a real tense moment between them. She sees it as an opportunity.
Again, it goes to the fact that we are not looking at these cases. You know, it wasn't Curtis Landon, Hopper, in the case that we profiled here on CrimeWire as well. No one is going to the girl. No one is asking the questions of the only person that was in the room when he died. It goes to that same thing. And that's what's happening. There's a pattern here on these cases, Vito, that we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, Peter's brought up some great things. I'd like to touch on a couple. He mentioned at the beginning when Peter started talking about polygraph, okay, not only on the girlfriend Rebecca Nelson, but I would want to polygraph Maria Harvick, because all we got on Maria Harvick is she's saying, you know, she's in the room and everything is saying according to Maria. Oh, they're in an argument. Maria leaves the room. She comes back in. Oh, he's got a gun supposedly in his hand. Rebecca grabs a gun. Maria leaves the room. We don't have any idea if any of that stuff is even true. So now like Peter said, if it's a suicide, there's no reason for deception, okay? So, Maria, help us out here a little bit. Take the polygraph. We need to see, maybe we could refresh your recollection through the polygraph to get some other points, you know? So that's an important thing to do. You don't handle somebody like this Rebecca Nelson with kid gloves, okay, that is streetwise. You never handle a person streetwise by a compassion type of approach to them. You don't get nasty with them, but you do what you have to do as a lead investigator to get to the point. And another saying that most top cops know, and you learn this in the police academy, I know I've said this on many shows, the old saying that people that show improper emotions for the circumstance, okay? And you're always looking for that, for people that are showing improper emotions for the circumstance. What I would probably have done if I'm the investigator working this case, shortly thereafter, if I'm suspecting Rebecca Nelson at all, I want to have one of my rookie cops or somebody follow her. I want to see how soon after Daniel's death does she hook up with another guy, okay? If she's hooked up within a week, 2 weeks with somebody else, that's improper stuff for the circumstance, okay? So there's a whole bunch of things
Mrs. Underwood,
go ahead.
Pardon me?
I said, yes, try the next day.
The next day?
The next day? She was with another guy?
According to Maria, it was the next night.
Okay, well then, you know, I'm not talking to her nice when I'm interviewing her. I'm going, you know, I'm saying, help me out here. Help me out. How can you be with somebody? He just died a couple of days ago. And you need this guy to console you? What's going on here? You wanted him dead, right? So, you know, the polygraphs are important. If you have nothing to hide, come on, come forward with this stuff. Like Peter said, suicide, no reason for deception. Follow her, see who she's hooked up with, and watch the emotions. Even on Maria Harvick, the friend that was there. You know, we don't know if any involvement or just maybe something she's scared about or hiding at all. So there's a whole bunch of things that should have been done on this. Peter, but excellent points, Peter.
There's an element there that Peter's describing, which is this type of demurring attitude that was towards Rebecca that comes right across in the video, and he's apologizing for asking any questions at all. She used certain indicators of deception that were clear and should have caught his attention. For instance, at times she would, when we got to the part about the death and where he was dying, she slipped into present tense language, which is an indication that she may be fabricating at that point, because the past tense language is with us at the time where we're about 3 or 4, even the latest 5 years old, we understand what past tense was. She slipped into that, but one of the parts that really grabbed me that was actually upsetting was she skips over a period of time by saying, the next thing I know, a gun is pointed at me. That expression is called a temporal lacunae. It means that they're jumping over time, and at the critical point, and this is where what Vito said about emotions, she is able to put down into emotions what she was thinking and what she was feeling at the time. That is deceptive. When you are going through, and when I am going through any type of trauma, we're on fight or flight hormonal overdrive. When someone puts the emotions in the quote-unquote perfect location, it is a sign that they are constructing a story. When she bent down, when he was down on the ground, when she skips that period of time, this is where I would like to get her in a polygraph with certain questions on what she did when she reached to his neck. And I am very concerned that she precipitated that death, or she expedited that death. So I looked for a pulse in his neck. I couldn't find one. And the next thing I know, I'm getting a gun pointed at me. And then she changes it back to herself. In that period of time, in that temporal lacunae, in that jump right there, I think something nefarious took place. I think something nefarious took place before that. But at this particular time, this is highly sensitive. This is a bad place to be. She said, I had a gun pulled on me by a cop, which I understand why. Let me tell you, an innocent person never understands why. Whatever a person can understand, why a cop pulled a gun or why they're being blamed or why someone may think that I'm guilty, is an indication of guilt and it needs to be explored. She understands why a gun was pulled on her. But think of that. If you have just witnessed a suicide and you are heartbroken, about the last thing that an innocent person will ever accept is any form of responsibility. So when she says, I reach for his pulse on his neck, and the next thing I know, something happened there, sensitive, a gun is pulled on me, and I can understand why he did that. Okay, what she's saying is, I'm trying to be your friend, interviewer. I'm trying to agree with you, and I'm trying to look innocent. It is a heavy portrayal of guilt.
Donna, can I ask you a quick question? Peter indicated earlier that he is under the impression that Rebecca may have been unfaithful to Daniel. Now, you mentioned that she apparently was with another guy the very next night after the death. But do you have you heard anything, or do you have reason to also think that she had another love interest while she was with Daniel?
Yes, I can back up a little bit further than that. Maria said when that they were they let them leave from the crime scene, and they were supposed to come back up to the police station. And Maria said when she looked up and Rebecca pulled back up to the police station for the interview, she had another man in there, Daniel Matheny, I believe was his name, that was supposed to be her ex-boyfriend that she was wanting to get back with. And this was pulling up to the police station a few hours after Daniel had been shot. So I was even going further into the future, which was the next night, that she actually went off with a guy that night. So, you know, I don't even know what happened that night. I just know that Maria said she came to the police station with this man.
Hey, Donna, how soon did they close the case, Donna?
Oh, I'm not really sure. I know he told us that morning that as soon as they got the autopsy, you know, they were pretty sure what it was going to be then. And I would say probably 2 or 3 weeks they were telling us there wasn't much more they could do. Then he turned around and said that he did set up a polygraph with her, and that was supposed to happen, and she didn't show up for it.
Hmm.
So it was probably a couple months then.
Do you have any contact with the detectives? Do you have any continual contact with them at all right now?
Oh, no. They didn't want to answer any questions when I called up there. After I got the tapes, and I had, you know, several questions to ask, and they didn't want to hear me.
Okay.
There is an indication within the language. At one point she says, "Now, baby, don't do that. Baby, don't do that. Baby, we'll talk about it." Doesn't promise resolution, but it is this simple, the language of infidelity. I woke up this morning. I said good morning to my wife, and I got dressed and went to work. That relationship's a bad relationship. And the reason I say it is because we all say good morning to our spouses. The fact that someone needs to portray that in an official statement means it's very important to them to be portrayed that way. It's an indication that and then there's the mention of another man that is completely glossed over by the interviewer. So as she uses these type of phrases, it's almost a typical domestic homicide situation. She didn't show up for the polygraph because she has a reason not to show up in the polygraph.
And they closed it without going and doing anything further? And that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it seems as though somebody should have just pursued a little bit more, and they didn't.
No, they didn't. I asked them after I had talked to Maria, you know, I asked the investigator how they come to the determination of how Daniel ended up on his back and laying on top of the gun, because Maria told me different. And he just got real upset with me, and he said, "What are you trying to say, that we didn't properly investigate the case?" And
there you go.
You know, he just didn't want to help at all. So I just quit talking to him.
So the death certificate
says how they made their determinations, you know, that her stories were consistent, and they just said there was no major differences in her stories. And
interviewer was really speaking so gently with her, she was using indications even when she described their argument. She would say it wasn't an argument, and obviously it wasn't. She used strong language. And then she said, "I just want to get home and take a shower." How many people would feel comfortable enough telling a policeman that she needs to take a shower? It entered into her language because it's significant. And I would explore, at this point, I'm thinking to myself, this is the symbolic washing of guilt. She is involved in a sexual relationship with someone else. She has been unfaithful to him. She has bled him, from what I could tell, on the money. She forged his account, and that wasn't something that was pressed forward. She just simply said, "He gave me the okay to forge his account." And she was involved with someone else. And I think that she had him in a terribly vulnerable position. And in that struggle with the gun, while he was down on the ground, he may have still been able to survive. And I think she sought to expedite it. And that's why she needed to jump off in time, and I think that's why she wanted to skip the polygraph.
Peter, we're running out of time real quick. If you could do a quick summation for us, what after your analysis and what you found, what do you think happened that night then? You think that she was complicit in Daniel's death?
Yeah, I think that he was depressed, and I think that he may have felt that his last bit of masculinity had been taken from her, and the infidelity was probably killing him. And so even if he had toyed with suicide, and Mrs. Underwood, I'm so sorry to say this, I think that she pushed him over and either pulled the trigger or precipitated that it would take place this way. I think she's complicit in his death.
Okay. Donna, a question. I don't want you to divulge anything you shouldn't hear, but I'm assuming this isn't the end of this, that you're going to pursue this further. Am I correct?
Yes, I am, and I'd like to get it reopened with some outside people coming in to investigate it. That's my goal right there.
Well, God, first of all, I know you've been through an awful lot here with several things, and I admire you for sticking to this, and I wish you every bit of success, and I hope you'll keep us in the loop or keep us informed as you move forward.
I will, and I appreciate y'all so much.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you.
Donna. Thanks a million, Peter.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Take care.
Oh, okay, we move on to our second case tonight. We're going to be talking with Heather Steele, who's the president and CEO of the Innocent Justice Foundation. The Innocent Justice Foundation leverages high technology solutions to help rescue millions of American children who are being sexually abused and prevent further abuse. They work to enable the investigation and prosecution of every child pornography offense in America by taking requests for help from overwhelmed law enforcement agencies and help the public understand the true nature and scope of child pornography crimes and victims in the United States. Welcome, Heather Steele, to the show.
Hi, you guys. How's it going?
Good.
Very good,
long time
Heather.
No talk. Yeah.
This work you do is amazing, and just looking at the child pornography facts that we have in front of us, we tend to know part of this stuff all the time by seeing different figures, but when we have all these different facts in front of us, it's amazing to see this. And one point I just want to start off with you, Heather, one thing that jumps off to me right away is that 55% of child pornography is produced in the United States. Now, our listeners need to understand that. You have the whole rest of the world, but 55% of child pornography is produced in the United States. That means 45% is split over the entire world. Is that amazing, Heather? Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, that's an estimate by a nonprofit organization in the UK based on viewing the images where the backgrounds are and where they think the images were taken. And I think it's really interesting for people to note that most child pornography is produced by one person alone. It's not in a studio like adult pornography is produced. So we have to kind of split it off in our minds that child and pornography, those two words should really never be in the same sentence, because what this is a child molester recording the rape and sometimes the torture of a child. And so these are crime scene images being produced by a child molester where he has a camera or a video camera set up to record the crime that he's committing against that child. And that we have the access to technology, we have the access to broadband internet, and our child molesters are the ones who are recording this abuse.
Okay, well, Heather, you're the CEO of the foundation, the Innocent Justice Foundation. How long has that been in existence?
It's been about exactly 3 years now. In fact, I would say it's been exactly 3 years now since I started the organization. So we're finally kind of, it's not a great time to start a nonprofit in the middle of a recession, but
right.
We're really starting to establish ourselves and grow at this point.
Oh, go ahead, Susan.
Okay. Does the media hurt this issue? Does the media hurt when they glean over it so fast in these cases and not do it? You know, I don't like the word story. their cases, their lives. And when the programs kind of gloss over, or the media or reporter glosses over the facts in a case, and, you know, you don't find out everything. You actually find out more from internet blogs, websites, you know, people getting involved, organizations like yourself. Do you think that the media has done this issue a disservice?
I'm agreeing right where you are, and I think the thing is that you're kind of pointing out the salient issue is that they simply don't cover it at all. They don't cover these facts at all. What they do is they seem to perpetuate this system of vague mistruths and things that are kind of myths out there, that they're always perpetuated. And what's frustrating for me is that the media doesn't even take any time whatsoever to kind of look at those myths and see if they're truthful or not, and taken some time to take a look at the research. And it doesn't take, you don't have to go far to find the real numbers and the real statistics and the real truth behind what's happening out there. And it is frustrating that they don't appear to want to know, and they don't appear to want to cover it, and they don't appear to want to even learn about it. It's just so abhorrent to people, even reporters, that even though we have a solution in our hands about how to stop child sexual abuse in this century, that it's just such a distasteful topic that very few reporters will cover it at all.
But in the cases where the kids go missing, in the cases where that's what happened to them, they don't report it, really. I mean, they just kind of, like you said, gloss over it without any facts behind it. And to me, organizations like yourself, that's why for people listening, this is so important, that this organization, to me, is one of the only ones in the country that is actually out there doing things. It's actually out there enlisting and providing so that somebody else doesn't have to be hurt or be killed by this. And people just don't want to see how often this goes on. Like you said, Vito, 55%. We think it's only in Thailand or Mexico or third world countries. It's right here.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. What our listeners need to understand, when you watch a show like Nancy Grace or Fox News and they show the board and they show the push pins, they say how many sexual predators are in a certain 2-mile area that they're doing a case on, and everybody's overwhelmed by, oh my God, look at that, there's 1,500 predators there. People need to understand that figure never will go down. It'll only be added to. So, you know, because the people every day are added to the sexual predator list. So that 2-mile area, another 2-mile area on the other side of the country, it's soon going to be covered so completely with these push pins, because it's never going to decrease. It's only going to increase.
And Vito,
well,
that's only the known.
The interesting thing about that is that
aren't in there.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Denny. That's exactly what I was going to say, is that that if you look on any Megan's Law website for the number of sexual offenders that live in your area, that's only 1%. Only 1% of these guys ever get caught, according to our calculations through government studies and through the law enforcement agencies that we work with. So times that by 100-fold is about how many predators are there.
That's amazing, Heather. That is truly amazing, because just listing the ones that are caught is overwhelming to some people when they see that. And to know that that's not even the tip of the iceberg is absolutely amazing.
And why don't you explain how you started this and why?
Well, I actually started the work about 5 years ago because I had a loved one, and I found child pornography on my loved one's computer. And I didn't know what to do about it. I was paralyzed. I had never heard of anybody that had ever had child pornography on their computer. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who to talk to. And I couldn't believe that this loved one, there was no way that this loved one was a pedophile. No way on earth. Could not have been. The most wonderful person I'd ever known in my life. I couldn't believe it. So it took me a while to really understand that this person was not who they say they were. So I did the research. It took me a long time to find the right police agency to go to. By the time I did, by the time I found our local Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, I'd been through several law enforcement agencies. I'd been through CPS. No one had believed me. No one. This person had such a standing in the community that I couldn't believe it. I mean, I have a strong educational background. I was an upstanding member of the community. I've never been in trouble in my life. I couldn't believe that someone wouldn't believe me when I went to talk to them. But I finally found our Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, and they believed me. But it had been a year, and the evidence had been destroyed. The computer had been destroyed. And they said, you know, honestly, we're so overwhelmed with the massive, massive caseloads and trying to rescue children under the age of six. You know, we would have had to triage that case anyways if it's just somebody who was found with child pornography. So, you know, what I really realized at that point was that this problem was overwhelming and that the public didn't understand how overwhelming this. I certainly didn't. I had a lot of misperceptions about child pornography. I spent this year trying to figure out what this is all about, read 14 binders worth of studies, you know, saved them all up, started to see the connections in my own mind, and actually just said to that ICAC team, that Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, what can I do to help you? What can I do to help, you know, change this paradigm where you're completely overwhelmed, you're triaging cases, you're only getting to 1%. And so they told me, and I started working with another organization that helps raise money for law enforcement agencies. And there are 15 of these police foundations nationwide that work with their local police to raise money for them. And I started to learn how nonprofit police foundations work. There's here in San Diego, we have the San Diego Police Foundation, and they have to raise a significant amount of money every year to cover the budget shortfall between what the government gives the police to do their jobs and what the police need to do their jobs. And there are some police foundations, like in Los Angeles, that have to raise over $1 million a year. So we raised up about $400,000 for our local ICAC team. And then when I met some of the other ICAC task force members throughout the U.S., they asked me to start a nationwide police foundation to help them too, to help the ones in Michigan, to help the ones in Wisconsin, to help the ones in Florida, that I just didn't help the ones in California. And so I did, and that's how it all got started.
Is there something with the manufacturer of the computers that could be done on a computer that would, you know, I mean, I know there's privacy issues and different things, and people are over a certain age, but is there a way to flag it? I know that there's some software by a company or two out there. I don't know how good it is as far as, you know, for children and things when they're trying to go on a site. But can a computer company, can a Microsoft or an Apple do something technology-wise perhaps that might, in the new products up and coming, and to a cell phone, because cell phones are now computers as well, that would be beneficial?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, the thing is that law enforcement has already developed this software. And that's how we know exactly how many predators are out there. So when I say that only 1% have been caught, it's because we know how many are out there because of this software program that tracks them on the Internet. So
it finds them like an octopus in a way. Like, you know, there's something that it tracks them or signals them?
Well, here's the deal. When someone looks at a child pornography image, what we call a child sexual abuse or torture image, which has a digital signature, it's called a hash mark. And so that can be identified. Okay, that's an identified image. So all of those images that have been identified as chargeable child pornography, their hash marks are saved in a database. So there's this program that watches people trading on peer-to-peer networks, on Napster, on, there's so many, Nutella, on a BitTorrent, on all of these peer-to-peer trading systems. When someone trades one of these files that has that exact same digital signature, that same hash mark, they know who traded it and when. They have that data at the aggregate level, and they can track them. So there's every ICAC task force has a computer where they can type in a zip code and see exact dots of IP addresses and where these guys are actually trading it in their zip code.
You mean they're trading photos?
Yeah, they're trading child sexual abuse and torture images.
Okay.
You can see, yeah, the law enforcement teams can see down to the street level where these guys are, and they know that there's over 624,000 individual IP addresses in the United States trading in child sexual abuse and torture images right now, and they can only arrest about 6,000 a year.
Heather, we had a question in the chat room, and maybe you could address this for us. Is there any difference, if you know, or in percentages, or the number of cases that are pursued, such as brought to court, when you have a child victim, the child porn stuff, versus the victim being an adult victim of some type of sexual abuse? Do they tend not to pursue when there's a child as the witness more, or how does that work?
That's a really interesting question. Well, let's look at it a couple different ways. There's one way in that adult rape is reported more often. I believe the report rates for women who are reporting rape are around 50% or maybe even a little bit higher. So you get a better start there that it's even been reported, and it's usually nowadays women have been educated to report immediately. We have rape kits. They know not to go take a shower and wash themselves. So all those things that you need to have good evidence so that you can take this all the way to prosecution, a case all the way to prosecution, that happens more often with adult victims. With child victims, what happens is only 5 to 8% of child sexual abuse cases ever get reported in a child's lifetime. And what happens is when those children do come forward, it's usually after weeks, months, or years of abuse. There's usually no physical evidence involved. And some of the kids are pre-verbal. And so they're not able to articulate what's been happening to them. They may not even know it's wrong. I mean, here we had a case in San Diego not too long ago where a father and a father had his daughter shower with him every day and was committing crimes on her in the shower and having her commit crimes on him, you know, because she didn't know. And she was in school later on, and she said, well, I thought every little girl went into the shower and did the thing to her daddy's wah-wah. You know, and then, you know, certainly everybody at that point, you know, was engaged in trying to help rescue this little girl. But, you know, she didn't even know that that was wrong because it had been happening to her since she was a little tiny child. So when we look at those kind of numbers, what you see is that child sexual abuse cases are kind of so handicapped from the beginning that they don't even, you know, it's very difficult to take them to court for a lot of different reasons. And, of course, children, it's the weight of a child's word against a community because these child molesters really manipulate the community so that the community thinks that they're really wonderful, really great, and they will victimize the children and say, you liars, you're trying to just get them in trouble. What's wrong with you? I see it all the time where a community stands up for a predator and vilifies a young child who actually had the courage to finally come forward. And so we see that, you know, these cases are so incredibly difficult to be prosecuted for a lot of different reasons. And it is my feeling that, you know, a lot of the kids are not considered credible witnesses just because they're not adults. But, you know, in these cases, even adults who stand up for them are not considered credible because the molesters do such a good job in manipulating and grooming the community.
So let me follow up on that with something else and I don't know if you would have an answer to this, but I've recently become aware of, well, I was aware of this before, but didn't realize how bad the problem is, of these children being sold and bartered off as sex slaves type things, aside from porn and taking pictures, where they have, I guess, pimps and
human trafficking.
Yeah, human trafficking. Are you familiar? Do you get involved much with that aspect of it, or is it primarily abuse by a loved one or a family friend?
Well, the Department of Justice statistics from crime statistics show that 96% of abusers are known and trusted by the child. So what they're, we're in the circle of trust of the child, and only 4% are strangers. So the beautiful thing is, child pornography is a horrible thing, but it is the first key we've ever had to get to that 96%, because it's that 96% that are molesting the children and taking images of it and trading images. And so we have that opportunity to go get them. It's not that the other 4% aren't a significant number. There's still a significant number of stranger danger, internet predators, and human traffickers. But we've been doing stranger danger for over 100 years in this country. And a lot of kids, I mean, there are hundreds of nonprofits out there doing internet safety, telling kids how to avoid predators. Everybody can get on board with that, the 4% of strangers. I think what people find most difficult to face is that 96%.
Look at. I think we haven't hit her on the show, but we will. Dawn Schiller, who wrote the Wonderland book about John Holmes, and she was groomed. She was groomed at a very early age, and was on the street. She was, you know, did what she was told, and she survived to have a wonderful organization, and she's one of the few. And then you've got Sarah Kurzan, who has been in jail for 15 years. When she was 11 years old, she was groomed by a 31-year-old man who was a pimp. He kept her in captivity, and she killed him, and she's not getting out of prison. So in some ways, Heather, the people that are standing up or speaking out or writing or doing things, this isn't a subject. It's still taboo. These young people who were the victims, And now are trying to change their life, do something with their life, where some have been locked up for protecting themselves. We've got that group that we don't know how many there are as well. It's increasing.
And Susan?
The numbers are staggering.
Yes, Vito.
From a police point of view, twofold. Number one, people like Heather, now she may have a good relationship in her area, but many times still across the country, the police do not cooperate with the people like Heather Steele, and it's a shame. They kind of like, well, yeah, that lady wants to come in, Mary Smith. She runs some kind of a agency, and she wants to talk to us about stuff. I mean, that does happen. I know that for a fact. That's number one. Number two, the states are supposedly all broke. So now what happens, and I know this for a fact, lately I've been corresponding with a lot of people, police departments are laying off, getting rid of 30, 40 people at a time. I know when I call them to see what's happening on certain cases throughout the whole Connecticut, New York area, many times they'll say to me, Vito, right now we're working on two murders and this rape case. We're like overwhelmed. We ain't going to get to this stuff for months. So you have that problem, and it starts right at the top, money-wise, and it's just unfortunate. Detective bureaus are cut to a minimum. There's no overtime anymore to conduct. You know, once your 8 hours is there, done, go home. I'm sorry, could continue it tomorrow, whereas before you used to work all night long and get those leads and follow up. And see, the trouble with all that is that you got that guy that's a predator. He may even kill a girl while all this stuff is going on, not only sexually assault them, but wind up killing them because the police just don't, you know, take care of this in the proper time. So you have a twofold thing going on right now.
But hasn't that been the way it always has been? I mean, if you look at Mark Class and you look at some of these other cases through the years, they've had those same, you know, police working on it, not working on it. I mean, I don't know that's always true. I think that these cases are in and of itself are just overwhelming. Yeah, the budget's there, but
yeah,
I think
it's overwhelming.
They should let people
like
Heather
in. See, a lot of times when there is the affordability of money, a lot of times, and I noticed the lieutenant will say to the detective, you just work this case. There's something going on here. Stay on it for a couple of weeks. And that's what you want to hear, because you can sink your teeth into it. You could come in days one day. The next day you could come in night shift if you need to do stuff. See, unfortunately, that's kind of like a thing of the past right now. You know, I got to take you off that case right now because we just had an accident with three deaths. you got to go jump on that now. Yeah, but I'm working this sexual assault thing. I'm sorry, got to pull you off of that. And that's the problem with these type of cases. And believe me, I talk to the police every day. They're my friends, and I just see what's going on, and it's absolutely horrible. They're not getting the money. They're getting cut back.
But couldn't
cut back
a group like Heather's, in my opinion, make it easier?
They could be tremendous help, Susan. I know exactly where you're going with it.
it's why I don't have an agency anymore, because of that attitude with people in law enforcement.
The
there's that lady again. No.
Knowing what I know now, if I'm chief of police or captain of detectives, I welcome people like Heather. Heather, come on in. Let's talk. How can you assist us? Let's work together on these things. Obviously, Heather, I may not be able to tell you certain secretive things, but we will share and we'll knock this stuff out together. See, that's the approach you have to have, because then you have, let's call Heather a kind of a semi-police officer working with her team to help me, the captain of detectives, you see?
Well,
and that's what you need.
There. Let's stop there, because we don't do any law enforcement work. So
No, not law enforcement.
No.
No, I'm talking about gathering of information, me picking your brains. No. I'm an ex-cop. I know you can't do that. You don't have powers of arrest, or you can't even go do things. I'm talking about funneling information to us that maybe we don't know about. You may say there's a Harry Smith. Do you guys know about a Harry Smith? He's on this road over here. No. Who is that? Well, he's been accused a couple times. I heard he just moved to this. See, information like that is valuable to us. No, you can't go on the street to conduct an investigation.
We educate law enforcement agencies, we educate high-level supervisors, and we let them know that they should be transferring, for their limited resources, for their piece of the pie, they should make ICAT crimes a bigger piece of the pie. And
right.
We are trying to get them a bigger pie. So that's part of what we do. We also educate policymakers about child pornography that they should be giving more money to their local ICAC teams and try to figure out in the community how we can get more money for our ICAC teams. And we are working here in San Diego with our regional government committee, and we meet every month to talk about raising more money and getting more legislative change that supports our ICAC team. So we provide them the tools that they need. Sometimes we get them funding for training. And we also provide mental health and wellness services for those who are exposed to these images, because it can be extremely traumatic to have to look at these all the time. But we do not get them names. We don't give them names. We don't give them leads. We don't do things like that, because we don't need to. They have 625,000 and more leads that they can't even get to right now. So they need the help in getting the resources from the money standpoint, from the boots on the ground standpoint, from the technology standpoint, so that they can follow up on those leads.
Heather, let me ask you this. Now you said earlier that you found yourself, you got involved because a loved one, you found porn on the computer, and I suppose at that point you had a couple of choices. You could have just severed your relationship, you could have ignored it, or you could have done and went on to report it. Which, how about the others of us? And law enforcement, as we're saying, is limited by budget, by personnel, so on and so forth. So can the average citizen, what can we do as average citizens not carrying a badge to help in the war against the pornography and the child sexual abuse and so forth? It's got to be a tough situation when you find a loved one, a son, a nephew, a brother, or whatever.
You must report it. You must report it, because children's lives are at stake. And you must report it, because if you don't, that may be the only chance to rescue a child and save a child's life. And if you don't, you will, trust me, regret it for the rest of your entire life. There's no way you can wash it away. You have to report it to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. There's a cyber tip line. That's where you report any child pornography that you find. You can even report child abuse, human trafficking. But let me tell you, Denny, and anybody else who's listening, you will never be able to forgive yourself later on for knowing that there are children out there who are being sexually abused because you did not go and report it to the police.
And I'm sorry, we're going to have you back. We're out of time. Heather Steele's website is www.innocentjustice.org. thank you so much for being with us. If it wasn't enough time, we're going to have you back. Please join us next week, December 14th. We want to thank our CrimeWire Director of Research, Kim Colton, Public Relations Team at ImaginePublicity.com. Tune in as we dissect, analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers, seeking justice, December 14th.
Thank you for joining us today on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you'd like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And you can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show by going to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night, and God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.